case. Alright, so so we're going to do a little experiment today, which probably won't quite work, but unless you do experiments, you never get things to work. So you will notice, so the goal of this experiment is that we'll be able to record on the computer the audio of my presentation in a way that's linked to the foils of the or the URL that I'm talking about. And we haven't quite got this right yet, so it's almost there. So that's why I'm wearing the microphone, because this microphone is going straight into the computer and diligently writing audio information. And the reason I happen to have this particular version of the computer web page is running is that this version is automatically logging which URL I am looking at the time. However, as I couldn't quite get all this working right, this is not really large enough to see, so I will actually talk to this file here. So the goal is that actually at the end of a presentation, a talk, or soon thereafter, in principle, within minutes of the end, you should be able to have online a set of foils which are exactly the foils I talked to, and with each foil there is an audio file which you can play, which you can then, which is recorded in this real audio technology, which is the technology that runs over 28.8 kilobaud modems, and so you should be able to listen to it in the comfort of your home or something. So that's the plan. So that's, and I believe that within a week or two we'll have this working well. That there's just, this is the first time we've tried it. All right. Now, all right, so we'll do the passwords and everything at the end of the lecture when there'll be more people here. So I just did that to make certain that it knew I was starting this file. So this file here, which is actually one we did last time, describes the communication overhead for this two-dimensional problem. You should notice that the homework, which is passed round, suggests that in the first problem set that you repeat this analysis here in essentially one and three dimensions, and then you notice the analogy with society by going through the two-dimensional analog of Hadrian's Wall, which is Hadrian's Palace. Which is so you should probably listen to this material, because you should be able to diligently replace one, two by one, and two by three, and square stencil by with grid points by palace floor with tiles, and solve the homework question. Okay. All right. So this here we did this last time. We're just, as it's a very important analysis, we'll go through it again. Namely, we noted that the communication for this overhead, which we need to look at in the case where there is the most communication, because that will dominate the overhead. We communicate 16 points and we update 16 points, so the total time is 16 times the calculation time plus 16 times the communication time, and then we stick that into the speed up. The 12.25 was the number we got from the load imbalance, and so we have this very absolutely standard form that the communication overhead always is a factor in the speed up, which is 1 minus the communication time over the floating point calculation time with some constant, which depends on the size of the problem and the particular application. It will turn out it will only depend on the so-called grain size, which is the number of points stored in each foil. Now, this already is actually, I think I didn't mention this last time, this form is pretty interesting and worth looking at for the following reason. Namely, what does it depend on? Well, we'll look at it again in the next foil, but here you notice it depends on t-com and t-float, and those are parameters of the node. And it doesn't have anywhere in it a dependence on the total system's parameters. It depends only on parameters of the node, because this is the communication time between nodes in the system, and this is the floating point computation time of a node. So this is quite important. In fact, it's probably better to discuss it in the next foil. Which does this general dependence, because we see that the this 4 actually is really the square root of n, where n is the grain size. So we see this degradation, the t-com square root of grid size times t-float. And this, the fact that this only depends on parameters of the computer, which is calculating this for the part of the problem, is why you get scaling. You see here that this only depends on square root of n, where little n is the so-called grain size, the number of points stored in each processor. T-com is the processor, the processor communication time. T-float is the processor compute time. So that means if I build a system which has 100 times as many processors, the degradation is still 1 plus t com over root n t float, and so the speed up is still affected by the same factor. So this dependence is the fundamental reason why parallel computing works, if you like. It's that the degradation due to the overhead doesn't have any terrible numbers that if you multiply, if you increase the size of the system, the performance does something terrible. It just always gets multiplied by a universal constant. So these comments are correct for so-called scaled speedup. Scaled speedup corresponds to keeping little n, the grain size, the same. When you do scaled speedup, you take a problem, and then if you multiply the number of processors by 100, you multiply the problem size by 100, so the grain size is the same. Now that's actually very natural, because I pointed out in the real world, you do not tend to keep the, when you have a big problem, you put more people on it. So in the computer world, when you have a big problem, you put more computers on it, or if you have a lot of computers, you put a larger problem on it. Scale speedup, in fact, is very natural. So this, in some sense, the fact that this wasn't really realized for a while, explains why parallel computing works. And it's also true that many people make comments that we should be very worried. We're just going up from to these 10,000 processors and the new DOE machines being installed in Sandia and then in Livermore. But it's quite obvious that they will work because of this argument here, because this will turn out to be, although the details will depend on the application, the fact that the degradation for the scaled speed-up case, which is when you do large problems with large machines, only depends on local parameters, means this issue of the size of the machine is sort of a bit of a red herring. Basically the size of the machine is relatively unimportant. It is not, most normal algorithms do not see any dramatic impact on the size of the machine as long as you do this scaling. So this just makes some of the same remarks in a different form. We noticed on the previous transparency that the speed up differed from the number of processes by this factor, which was which depended on local parameters. So that says that we it is particularly useful to look at the concept of efficiency, because efficiency is, I mean, by definition, speed up divided by the number of processes. And we saw before that speed up was naturally dependent on directly proportional to the number of processes. And so when you look at the efficiency, you will find either that efficiency is 1 over 1 plus the overhead, or correspondingly this overhead we've derived is 1 over the efficiency minus 1. And the most important overhead in this class of problem is the communication overhead. And we showed that the overhead was T term over T float, and then for the Hadrian's wall, 1 over the square root of n. What you're asked to do in the problem set is, by looking at one-dimensional problems and three-dimensional problems, to show that the general form of the overhead for this problem class is a constant divided by the grain size to a power, where that power is 1 in one dimension, 1/2 in two dimensions, and 1/3 in three dimensions. And so that points out that that although the functional dependence depends on the nature of the problem, you still have the same essential feature that the overhead only depends on local parameters of the problem. So if you build a nifty node, it shouldn't matter how big your system is. All you've got to make certain is your node performs well, the communication between nodes is fast enough, then you should be able to scale up to arbitrary sizes and retain excellent performance. Now, so these foils are very nostalgic, if you like, to me, because I produced effectively these diagrams back in 1983 when I first proposed that hypercubes could be used on more generally parallel machines for this problem. And when I went through this, essentially the argument, which in probably a less elegant fashion of the previous foils, people told me, well, that's all very well, Jeffrey, for such simple problems as Jacobi iteration, where you have a nearest neighbor algorithm, but real problems are different. The update of a given point doesn't just depend on the nearest grid point, it depends on next to nearest neighbors, or its long range forces, etc. And so I initially just grunted. But actually, when you look into the situation, you will find, as I pointed out to you last time, that actually Laplace's equation of the nearest neighbor structure is the hardest example. It has actually the general form, this elegant fact that the overhead only depends on local parameters, but the size of that overhead as the ratio is actually largest for Laplace's example. And that's a little counterintuitive, and this file is meant to which is interesting. I should update this. We'll have to see how we do this in the audio. It's clear that there's a missing file here, which is a critical file, unfortunately. I will add it and correct the audio appropriately, which shows, but anyway. So at least you'll have that on record when we get all this done. Because the next file, cases D and E, are really the crunch line, which show what's going on. So all this file says, points out, is that at least the trend is interesting, namely, the problem I've just done for you is situation A, where we have the structure. Here we have a processor. We again, it's 4x4 grid points, and for a nearest neighbor, so-called stencil or template, which is shown here, we get this overhead, which is 1 over root n times t comma over t calc. So what do we do in B? Well, we actually do the stencil, which mathematically, when you do linear algebra, you'll find out is the correct stencil for doing the next best approximation to del squared with fourth order differences instead of second order differences. You will find that you need to transmit, it's a very simple analysis, you don't just transmit the neighboring points, you transfer the neighboring points and the next to neighboring points. It's sort of obvious that if your grid point depends both on the neighbor and the next to neighbor, here that would need this, which won't turn out too good on the audio, will it? The net result is that the total communication is obviously twice as much. So that's why people, when I first described this in lunch in the Caltech cafeteria, told me that there was going to be a problem when you went to more complicated stencils. Obviously, the communication is going to go up. However, the critical observation is that although it's clear the communication is going to go up, the overhead is communication divided by computing. And as soon as I go to this stencil, which is now a 9-point stencil instead of a 5-point stencil, roughly the amount of computing is also doubled, because in order to calculate the initial point, I have to actually average the results with actually different coefficients of 8 points. And because they're different coefficients, it's actually a little more than twice the computation, because I have to multiply by 2 coefficients, not by 1. So you actually find the overhead is reduced. The overhead goes down by 10%. So the interesting feature of Laplace's equation is it is true that the communication is least, but it's also true that the ratio of computing to communication is least, because it's such a simple algorithm, it does very little computing. So diagram C actually does a simple stencil, which is a 9-point stencil, which is essentially all the neighbors around a point. So that's what you'd get if you were doing a molecular dynamics problem where these were atoms sitting at sites, and then the force law of these atoms was such that you just included all the points in some sort of in the immediate neighborhood. Now this is quite interesting, because you actually, apart from these corner points, transmit essentially the same number of points as up there, but because we have an 8-point stencil, or 9 with the middle one, the actual overhead has now gone down. So when we've done this more complicated algorithm, which has these corner points as well, the overhead has decreased. And with this foil I have to add, which actually now makes this radius of interaction bigger, you will find as you make the radius of interaction bigger, you will find the communication, which is linear in the number of points that are included, increases, but the computational load increases faster, and you'll find this overhead just gradually decreases. And so actually, of all the examples you can simply think of, Jacobi iteration, or this Laplace update, or this is actually the update for the simplest spin models, is actually the worst. It's got the highest overhead. And so this property of good performance and the property of scaling did not come from the nearest neighbor structure. It came because it's present for any force law of any range. They all have the property that the speed up has the is a dependent only on a grain size, only over t time over t cap with a constant. All these algorithms have this feature. And so it is a universal characteristic of all these problem classes of essentially entities interacting with neighboring entities with various different laws for deciding what the neighboring entities are. And it is not a special feature of Laplace's example. All those problems will give you right answers. So that's quite interesting, say, for numerical analysis. It says it doesn't matter what differencing law you use or whether you use finite elements or finite differences, this structure will always be true. So you're always sort of underlying, you're bound to get scaling parallelism. Yeah, that's as long as you implement it correctly. This is only true if you implement it correctly. And actually, we can even discuss the correct implementation here because this is quite relevant for compilers. In calculating the fact that the communication over calculation was essentially the same in these two cases, I assumed that I did these sort of guard rings of actually twice the size and just communicated this total of 32 points. Now, I could write the program in a very bad fashion and notice that this point here, which is outside the processor but next to it, is needed for the update of this point and this point, namely of 2 points inside the processor. So if I wrote a simple algorithm, however non-optimal, I might be tempted to communicate this point twice, once when I'm updating this point and once when I'm updating that point. And then I would get a very bad scaling law. So the intuition that things get worse when you make the size of the interaction large actually comes from the fact that you're really calculating, you're intuitively calculating every point weighted by the number of times it's used. But if you write, and this is why I say when you write compilers, it's extremely important to do an analysis of finding out exact how much, or if you're a user doing it yourself, really what information you need for this round of the update, and you count the points once and once only, and you just communicate all the points. You do not do the analysis by taking each point that needs to be updated, bring everything in, do the update, throw the information away, and start again. That would give you a very bad performance. So it's critical to do this analysis. The reason we get good scaling and relatively controlled overheads is because we do the minimal amount of communication. Of course, if we were doing this feature that points are reused, is actually, of course, important in all computer architectures. You probably are aware that any microprocessor today has very large caches on it. So what's the purpose of a cache? The purpose of a cache is to say when you do a computation, the data is stuck in this fast cache, which is nowadays going to be on chip, and then you do not have to go to main memory when you reuse it. So the theory behind caches is that in a lot of computation, information is reused. So what I'm saying here is when we do parallel computing, the key to getting good performance is to analyze the reuse and make certain you communicate things once and once only. So effectively what we're saying is we're caching the data. This final file basically compares scaled speed up with non-scale speedup, and I've essentially gone through this central point already. Namely, if you do speed up at fixed grain size, which means that the problem size is directly proportional to the machine size on at least these simple problems, which are, let's say, really very typical, because any CFD wouldn't get into this class of problem, and the majority of large-scale physics simulations, you will always get linear speed up. So the scale speed up will always be linear in the number of processes, because that's what our analysis showed, that the degradation was just a constant factor which only depended on fixed parameters of the machine and the grain size. The alternative, obvious, interesting speed up is the fixed problem size speed up. You take a given problem and then you increase the number of processes. Well, that's Amdahl's law, or too many cooks spoil the broth. Namely, if you fix the problem and increase the number of processes and look at the speedup formula, then clearly the grain size, which is the number of problem points per processor, is going to go down, because the grain size is directly proportional to 1 over the number of processes. So as I decrease the grain size, I'm going to increase the communication overhead, because communication overhead is an edge over area effect. As I make the amount of information stored in each processor smaller, the edge effects get bigger, and so we get smaller and smaller work done per processor, and then you'd expect, and in fact you see always, the speed up to level off. So this leveling off with the speed up is very typical of fixed, or something like fixed problem size, because that makes the grain size proportional to 1 over the number of processes. So, alright, so that's all I wanted to say, which sort of finishes Tuesday's lecture on about speed up. And it's not, you will find it discussed in not only several papers, it's done in, as I mentioned in the problem set, if you actually look at the online book Parallel Computing Works, it reproduces a lot of these arguments. It's also done in my older book, Solving Problems in Concurrent Processes, has essentially all this analysis in it. But it's really quite straightforward, and as far as I know, in some sense, that there isn't anything else there is. I mean, this is basically captures the essence of all problems. There are some problems which don't get the same elegant formula, but those are problems with a far more complex algorithmic structure, which are not well represented by these geometrical pictures I've been drawing. But most problems are actually of this geometrical structure, and even when they're not, this general analysis tends to hold. And so are there any questions on speed up? TCOM is, it's actually sort of interesting, in some sense we made a mistake. Namely, in the machines we originally built, TCOM was comparable to TCALC. Now you could say that's because we used a lousy microprocessor, we used the so-called Intel 8087, which its performance wasn't measured in megaflops. This was the first floating point microprocessor essentially ever built. It had a performance of 1/20th to 1/50th of a megaflop. And we were able to build a communication network, which was clocked to whatever it was, 8 megahertz or something, and it gave you a TCOM comparable to TCALC. Unfortunately, if you now go to a modern microprocessor, capable of doing, 100 floating point operations in 10 to the minus 6 seconds, you're going to be your communication performance is going to be nowhere near your floating point performance. So TCOM is much larger than TCALC, and the other, it's a little complicated to say what it is, because there is a huge so-called latency effect. We will discuss this in a little more detail later on. Namely, the real formula, there is no such, it really isn't a TCOM. What there is a TCOM which depends on the message size, because the way you send messages between processors is you gather all the data you want, and then you add a header and you stick it in a buffer, and the system wakes up and sends it over to another node. And the hardware and software overhead of sending a message means that the time to send a message is a constant plus another constant times the number of words transmitted. So I think for something like the SP2 today, the latency is 30 microseconds. So that says that in the time it takes to send a zero-length message, in principle, you could do many thousands of floating-point operations. And so that's actually what saves you there. So what saves you is that you have to go to a large grain size, and you notice that I pointed out that you can identify the points that need to be transmitted, and that's something like all the points on the edge. And so again, that's a very important technology called blocking in compilers, that you want to make your messages as big as possible. You will also notice, if you look at Laplace's example, it's also the hardest from the point of view of latency. Just because it's got the simplest computation, the natural messages are smaller than for the more complicated force laws. So you will find that actually, say, computational fluid dynamics, which is a much more complicated computation, actually has smaller natural coefficients, but also has much larger messages. And so the latency effects are much smaller. But because you have latency in there, some of the elegance of my argument goes away. The essential points are there, but you tend to be dominated by latency in interesting regimes. But it's essential. So you see two reasons to sort of analyze what needs to be communicated. A, we don't want to ever doubly communicate values, and secondly, we want to block to avoid the latency impact. Right, so now we're going to go to a different section of the course, which is not a detailed discussion of computer architecture, where we'll actually discuss a lot of things like distributed shared memory and latency in more detail, but some sort of overview of the principles behind the architectures of high-performance computers. If you're designing, if you're sitting there trying to design for the next generation or high-performance computer that's going to sell a lot of machines, you sort of have two choices you can make. You probably have several choices, but you have two broad classes of choices you can make. You can be very bold and choose a radically new technology. You can build it out of different things. So, you know, once you've invented an anthill, you could decide that was a nifty parallel computer which had certain capabilities, but then we better invent bees. We could then use bees as a technology, or monkeys, or people, and then we get the parallel computers of greater capability. So that's technology. Substance or the thing which we make our computer of. But once we've chosen what we're going to make the computer of, then we can design it in different ways, and that's called the architecture, which is the sort of a less radical choice. So we're going to discuss. Both technologies, and architectures. And we'll briefly discuss some of the technology choices, in particular quantum technologies or superconducting technologies. And which are sort of radical technologies which you might want to use, even within the sort of traditional CMOS approach. You, I don't know whether you view this as an architecture choice or a technology choice. There's sort of been an interesting commercial feature, namely, there's been a debate as to whether you should build your computer out of existing microprocessors, like the IBM SP2, if you like, is built out of an existing IBM chip, RS6000 chip, or the Silicon Graphics Power Challenge machine is built out of the R10000 or whatever your latest MIPS chip is, and the T3D was built out of the digital alpha chip. So these were all conventional microprocessors. Well, the other choice is to say, well, these are not very good units. We better, we can obviously design a chip that's better for parallel computing, better designed for parallel computing. I showed you last time, say, the NQ2, which was a chip carefully designed for parallel computing, in that it had communication channels built into the chip, enough to wire a high-dimensional hypercube, and it had mechanisms in there which were going to make parallel computing faster. The problem with designing a custom chip is basically the time and effort it takes to build a custom chip. And so this is what you call, this one we'll come back, and I think we already mentioned it, is the sort of silicon juggernaut problem, or the CMOS juggernaut, or the consumer juggernaut problem, namely, incredible amounts of money are put in the consumer electronics industry. And the nice number which Gordon Moore mentions on his tape, which I keep threatening to show you, is that if they look at, if the semiconductor industry estimates how much money they need to invest for the next generation of microprocessors, it's $40 billion. So here you have an enterprise building the next generation Pentium, or whatever it's going to be called, chip, which is going to sell 100 million PCs. If you divide 40 billion by 100 million, I think it's $400 per PC. So every PC, actually there's $400, I believe, which is just the investment in the plant to manufacture that PC. Let's hope that's right. I think it is. And that's sort of, why is that an interesting number? So here you come along as a graduate student at Syracuse University, well, I can build a better chip. So here you are, you invest your $1,000 in building a new chip, and so it looks better, but then you have to go into manufacture and stuff, and it's very difficult to compete with this entire enterprise, which is all carefully optimized and making wonderful PC chips. So they're not as good as parallel processing chips. But there's $40 billion behind them, and that makes them come out real fast, and they can make the very best use of the latest feature size and get it reduced. So they're on an incredibly accelerated schedule, which makes it extremely difficult for novel ideas to get in there, because that's $40 billion. You just can't compete. So this is, if you like, so this is a plus and a minus of technology. The fact that semiconductor technology is so successful and doing so wonderfully makes it very hard for any other ideas to creep in because of the huge investment that's needed to be competitive. So there's a huge barrier. And so a good example, I think, is, I'm not a great expert in this area, is gallium arsenide. Gallium arsenide, I think, is better in many ways than CMOS silicon technology, and it's mainly because it's faster. It's just electrons, it's got lower resistance, so it's got the electrons just go faster, so it has higher clock speed. But it's only a factor of two. So there's no way the industry can justify the huge investment necessary to switch either switch or even add capability. I mean, they can't duplicate to do gallium arsenide, even though you can share some things. It's just not competitive. So we'll come back to this when we mention superconducting technology, which, because if we compare gallium arsenide, it doesn't stand a chance. It's only a factor of two. But superconducting is a factor of several hundred, in some sense better than silicon technology. So it might stand a chance. Okay. All right. So that's sort of technologies. So I'm not allowed to talk about it until we do this. So the architecture of a computer is, in our wonderful analogy with society, equivalent to the organization of the design of these processing units called people in society. So you could either think of different models for society or different groupings, villages versus businesses and so on. So it's quite obvious they're just endless organizations in society, and there is no one best organization. So I don't know whether this is a good analogy, but I decided it would be useful to distinguish between formal organizations and informal organizations. So a good example of a formal organization is a military organization that's sort of very structured and carefully designed, whereas Woodstock or some sort of crowd event would be very informal. There would still be structure, there would still be some interesting linkages, but it wouldn't be structured. So the reason why I suggest that's an interesting way to think about it is that, as we've mentioned I think already, so-called metacomputers, which are basically what I call an informal high-performance computer, so this is what you get by just taking your a set of PCs or CCs and workstations or workstations or whatever you want and linking them with your existing network or your ATM add-on network. That's what I call an informal architecture, because you just take what you have and you make do with what you have. It's not particularly optimized because it really was put there for a different purpose, but it's still a parallel computer, just as a crowd is still in some sense a processor is designed to say to clap maybe at the end of each song or something, or absorb, become happy by listening to the concert. But so it's still a processor of some sort, but it's less formal. Okay. The main point, which I think I've already meant, is that the informal machines, the pneumatic computers, are not qualitatively different in some sense from the formal machines, just as a bunch of people at Woodstock is the same as a bunch of people at some level as an army. They're just organized in a different fashion, but they still speak using voice or what have you, and they have a lot of the same characteristics. So essentially, the algorithmic and software study of informal machines is the same as the algorithm and software as formal machines, but the trade-offs are different. We've already discussed the importance of latency. So network latency is almost always higher, and network bandwidth, which is TCOM, is almost always lower for an informal machine than for a formal machine, because the formal machine has been carefully optimized to get very good performance in this area and to match the network performance of the processor performance. So TCOM over TCALC is what is necessary to do problems of relevance, whereas in the case of the informal machine, it's whatever you get, and it may or may not be relevant. So essentially, the formal machines are typically what you study, partly because they are really the optimized ones, so they're intellectually the cleanest. They are the ones that are going to get the best performance and the highest performance on any one problem. And sort of from a computer science point of view, they use, if you like, computer science to decide what the right processor nodes is, what the right network is, how to link memory and processors, what the right I/O is, and so on, and what the right synchronization mechanism. So we will tend most of our work to sort of refer to these formal machines, but you should remember that really there isn't any difference. So you will not get me to tell you that there is a best machine, just as you won't get me to tell you there's a best organization in society. There's just different organizations with different trade-offs. Namely, you put people in businesses or cities to do a different problem than putting them in armies. That doesn't mean that one is better than the others, they're just different. There's a better analogy is communication. There are all sorts of different ways of computers communicating with each other, but you also will see that people have an enormous different ways of communicating with each other, and they have different trade-offs. Namely, if you want to go and visit a friend and they're just down the road, you will walk, because it would be foolish for you to get in your car and drive, because that car will give you, has latency. You have to get in the car, find parking, etc. So car is an example of a high bandwidth, high latency mechanism, because it's got a lot of capability. That capability comes with latency. Another nice example I like to use is Syracuse Airport. Syracuse Airport doesn't have many flights, but it's very low latency because there's hardly anybody there. If you go to Los Angeles or O'Hare, you can go anywhere, so it's got lots of interesting features as a switch, but it's a huge latency. It's 1 hour on the freeway in Los Angeles, and there are all these dreadful terminals you have to walk between, and they're all a long way, and you've got to allow another hour to get anywhere, so the latency is much higher in Los Angeles than it is in Syracuse. But that's not to say that one is better than the other, just different. And of course going by air is an example. If you go walking, car, air, you just go trade-offs to higher latency and higher bandwidth. You would not take your plane to go and visit your friend in the next door house. That would not be a very clever idea. Alright. So all that says is there is not a bet. So there is, there are going to be lots of communication mechanisms. There's not likely to be a single universal solution. They're just solutions with different trade-offs. So before we get on to somewhat more near-term things, we will briefly discuss and a couple of far-out technologies. The farthest out is quantum computing, and I give you here three references. One is, this is probably the best, is a Scientific American article of October 95 by Seth Lloyd from MIT. Tony Hay, my friend in Southampton, has just come out with the transcripts of Feynman's lectures on computation, which he gave at Caltech in 83 to 85, which includes a chapter on quantum computing. And then I happen to be reading Physics Today, the latest book, which is the sort of physics magazine, which is very critical of quantum computing as being totally unrealistic and doesn't stand a chance of working, etc. So the main thing to note about a computer is that there's not many constraints on what a computer is. A computer, to build a computer, you better have a physical system that has that sort of evolve that when you do that you put some input in, which are going to be bits of information, and you get an output, and you have some control over that output, so you can decide whether the bits are going to be added or subtracted or logically put together. So a computer just requires a physical system. So it's not terribly surprising that we could use quantum mechanics in doing it for the evolution of the physical system, or in this magic, this rather exotic thing called DNA computing, we can use chemistry. Because these are all things that change. I mean, proteins change in time, and they do things in a relatively deterministic fashion, because they obey Newton's laws. So it is not too surprising that we can build a whole, we can at least in principle build a whole set of computers basically exploiting different physical systems. And actually, if you look at these really far out articles, they are quite interesting, because they do show that there is really no fundamental limitation on the power of a computer. I mean, if you look at today's CMOS computers, they have, although they're they're advancing very wonderfully, there's some fundamental energy limitations that you just can't build a computer bigger than a certain size because it would cost too much energy. Those energy limitations are not anything fundamental. They're just a property of the technology used, not of computing. So there's no reason to believe 100 or, well, I don't know, let's say 100 years from now, that you could not, or even 50, have a computer built according to completely different principles from what you have today. At least there's no, there might be practical reasons, which people will discover, but there's no theoretical reason. There are no theoretical, essentially no theoretical constraints on computers, as far as I know. By the way, if anybody wants to borrow or look at this nifty book by Feynman, which is poor Tony Hay labored many years to get this out, because I remember when I was at Caltech, I had to go and find the students, try to find students who'd taken the course to get the notes. And so it's a sort of labor of love of Tony, who was a postdoc at Caltech when Feynman was alive, still alive. My main contribution to the course, I was executive officer for physics at the time, so I scheduled the course. I also gave a guest lecture on the hypercube, but the only real contribution I made was scheduling it. All right, so if you sort of analyze it, a computer, you have to be able to sort of prepare an input. You better be able to program it, which means you better be able to control what it does. You better be able to produce an answer in some sort of reliable fashion, and it better be do it. And this is actually one of the criticisms of a quantum computer, in that these quantum wave functions that are going to be doing this computing are incredibly fragile, and it seems very with current knowledge, it's very difficult to see how you control them and get reliable answers. But of course, if we're talking 50 years from now, almost anything can happen in 50 years if it's allowed by the laws of physics. So I think it's quite plausible that quantum computers will exist 50 years from now and be incredibly interesting. Anyway, so it better be reliable, and to be useful, at least on some important computations, it better be quicker than other techniques, and there better be some way of getting the answer, because there's not much point if it computes it and hides it from you. So those are really the only constraints that you have to manage. You have to be able to satisfy. Now, if you, as long as we think we're dealing with numbers, which is not necessary to have as a restriction, but at least is we might as well restrict ourselves to manipulating numbers, which could of course be characters represented by numbers. Then we can suddenly think of everything as bit manipulation, and then it's well known, and say, for instance, explained in detail in the book, in the article by Feynman, that you can build arbitrarily complex arithmetic as long as you can find some way of doing a not function and some way of doing an and function. Once you do that, those circuits allow you to build arbitrarily complicated computers. And that's sort of, if you just look at a standard book on the LSI, they effectively say that. But of course, and in fact, if you look back at the beginning of the VLSI, which is really not too long ago, they were started off by just doing those types of circuits. So one neat thing about quantum systems, which is why you might even want to think about quantum computing, is that quantum systems certainly represent bits in a natural fashion, because a spin of if you take a neat, nice elementary particle or relatively elementary particle like an electron or a proton, then that has a spin, which is spin a half, so it's either up or down. So an electron carries a single bit of information just in its spin position. We can go a little higher up in the into atomic systems, and then we can have a hydrogen atom with an electron traveling around a proton. That hydrogen atom, that electron is in quantized orbits, which say they could, so you can have a bit represented by, is the electron in the lowest energy state or in a higher energy state? And as described, say, by Seth Lloyd, you can even read that it, by just impinging in the right energy photon on that electron, you can find out which energy state it's in. So because quantum physics is built around energy states, and which are inherently discrete, quantum systems actually in many ways are intrinsically natural for bitwise arithmetic. So, right, so we better get some arithmetic. So, basically, there is no, if you like, universal way of doing arithmetic, because to get an arithmetic, you better start with a state and change it. Well, that's easy enough, because things interact with each other. So spins interact with each other. And when one spin flips, which is the nature of the value of a data point flip, usually the interaction between spins, the other spin may or may not flip. Which will be, which with suitable strength of the interaction, we can then build these fundamental logic circuits. So just the fact that quantum physics, quantum systems are built out of interacting particles says, at least in principle, we cannot build one computer, but lots of different computers which will just differ in the nature, in the particular interaction that we exploit to build such a system. And I've already mentioned that we can find out which state the system is, which is just effectively an I/O capability, by sending in a photon. And that's sort of almost the end of the theory of quantum computers, because as this scurrilous article in Physics Today pointed out, it's essentially impossible to build a serious-sized quantum system which has got enough control on it that you could conceive of computing anything of any interest to anybody today. So we wait for engineers of the future to be able to produce and control systems which allow us. However, the last few remarks on quantum computers note the following, that in the classical world, a system is either, if a system has two states, is either on or off. Now, one of the features of quantum physics is that the fundamental description of a quantum system is not the state of it, it's its wave function, which is, and then the square of the wave function gives the probability that it's in a particular state. And so there are a wave function that says that the system is in a spin is in the up state, there's a wave function that says the spin is in a down state, but there's also a perfectly good wave function which says it's half of the time in the up state and half of the time in the down state. So these so-called qubits, which are these quantum bits which are intrinsically zero or one, inevitably carry with them some sort of nifty new type of logic, which is these either-or logic. They're either in one or the other. And technically these would be called coherent states, and there is a description by Seth Lloyd of how coherent states can give you different types of compute capabilities. An obvious example is random numbers, namely, if you have a system that you know is in one of these coherent states, which is equally often up or down, then you only have to measure that system, and when you measure such a system, you'll get a state which is either up or down with equal probability. So such a physical system gives you automatically a random number generator. And you may know there is the only random number generators you have in digital computers are synthetic. They just generate such a complicated number that it's essentially random, so-called pseudo-random number. We'll discuss that. Feynman notes that such computers are actually have some obvious, not so surprising capabilities of simulating quantum systems, because the world is a quantum world. You just usually can ignore its quantum effects, but if you are going to study any fundamental physics or actually even a lot of fundamental chemistry, you must simulate quantum systems. And so these qubit computers, because they're inherently quantum mechanical, could provide incredibly fast algorithms. So this will be a really nifty place for algorithm people to work. So that's the end of quantum computing. So I should say that one of the reasons I'm doing these exotic technologies is, for me, I have spent a lot of time over the last 6 months, I think as I mentioned, studying so-called petaflop computers. These are the computers of 10 years from now, which will reach 1,000 times the day's performance, namely 10 to the 15th operations per second. And so in trying to understand where those architectures are, what they're going to look like, we have tried to analyze technologies and architectures to see where they're moving. I believe there are some relevance to this class, and we'll get onto this later on, because the deduction of these 10-year-out machines is that they will have architectures that are relatively different from today's architectures, and they will have challenges for both algorithms and software, which it is not too soon to think about now, and because there you can see some sort of inkling of these issues in today's machines. And so I believe that, you know, when you think it takes 5 years to build a compiler, if I'm going to tell you the architecture of the computer is going to change in 10 years, it's worth knowing that, because you need to build that into your work. So quantum computing I really discuss just because I think it's sort of neat. And it's not going to be relevant 10 years from now. There is no way you're going to build a quantum computer of any relevance 10 years from now. So, 50. However, something you can build 10 years from now, which could be very interesting and very important, is a superconducting computer. And that is one of the most promising architectures for the 10-year-out computer. So here, in a nutshell, is something about superconducting. So this is not, here, remember, I'm talking about technology now, not architecture. This is the unit, the thing we build the computer out of. So this is going to be a radical change. So quantum computing was a technology, because we were building the computer out of different units. Superconducting is a technology, because we're going to build the computing out of totally new things. Although they're actually going to use the same fabrication lines, or essentially the same fabrication lines. All right. So superconductors come in there with some nifty advantages. Namely, they are able to, they're working on a time scale which is essentially a few picoseconds. A picosecond is 1,000th of a nanosecond. I think I pointed out earlier on that in today's technology, essentially CMOS technology levels out at a nanosecond clock period. At any real, in the next 10 to 20 years, you will not get significantly faster than a clock speed of 1 nanosecond. Today, you're about a third of a nanosecond. I'm sorry, about 3 nanoseconds, 300. I mean, 300 megahertz is a typical fast processor today. Maybe 400 for the very best, and maybe Pentiums are around 150 to 200. So those will only go up about another factor. You know, go up to 10 to the minus 9 seconds as a clock period. And one of the reasons is that these they're using electrons traveling around effectively in wires in metal to communicate information, and there's resistance. And as you make the feature size smaller, the importance of that resistance gets more and more important. And essentially, in today's technology, you've now reached the point of diminishing returns. Up to now, clock speeds keep going down, because as you reduce feature size, the wire lengths go down. So that says your typical time goes down, because if you have a constant velocity. After you make the feature size get smaller and smaller, the resistance goes up, and so as part of the effect is diffusive, your time period, your fundamental clock period will start going up again, or will be limited. So CMOS is sort of limited roughly to a nanosecond. So superconducting is interesting, and this is its fundamental advantage, is just much faster. Superconductors have no resistance, because that's the nature of that's what superconducting means. There is no resistance to the motion of a superconductor. So that says that, so if you look into the sort of practicalities, it says there's no fundamental reason why you can't have clock periods which are just a few times 10 to the minus 12. So this is several hundred times faster than a traditional current type of technology. And that performance is true for both the superconducting logic gates and for the superconducting wires. Both of those can increase in performance. And you build these things out of niobium, and you can build niobium chips, high integration chips, using essentially the same technology, same fabrication techniques as CMOS. Josephson, who invented superconducting junctions, these very straightforwardly allow you to effectively build transistors with this technology. So you have switches. But IBM and, in fact, Japan cancelled all their work in this area. IBM in 1983, Japan in 1990. So, there's a very clever gentleman, actually, an immigrant from Russia, Mr. Likharov, who was at State University of New York in Stony Brook, just a couple of hundred miles south of here, who has pointed out, and probably others have done it as well, but he has made it in a most coherent fashion, that although IBM, using the approach it was doing, was correct to realize it didn't stand a chance of competing, that you can change their approach using a somewhat different superconducting effect, namely the fact that in a superconductor, magnetic fluxes are quantized in fundamental units, and this allows you to store bits of information in a very elegant fashion. You can build these so-called rapid single flux quantum devices, which gives you a nice way of representing a bit. This is a macroscopic quantum effect that you're exploiting. And that these systems can be built today, and he has demonstrated them, with clock speeds measured in the hundreds of gigahertz. Now, the systems he's built today with 100 gigahertz clock speed are not full-function microprocessors. They're simple circuits. But he's built slower, effectively full-function microprocessors, and I guess the expert's analysis is there is no reason why, with the right investment, that in 5 to 10 years, you cannot build a Pentium, if you like, processor out of superconducting technology, which has a clock speed of hundreds of gigahertz. So hundreds times faster than the CMOS processor of the same time period. So this is pretty interesting. So why isn't Silicon Graphics and Intel and everybody going diverting all their effort to superconductivity? So I guess we're finished with this file today. So this is why they're not. So I've already mentioned this horrible number of $40 billion. Well, it's not horrible, it's remarkable. But there is possibly, if you add the industrial investment and the academic investment and the international investment, maybe there's $100 million a year of effort going into superconducting. So $100 million is not very big compared to $40 billion. So even if Intel thinks superconducting is better than what they're doing, they find it very difficult to do anything because they have to grow that $100 million investment with all the experience of how you build, all the things you need to build. They have, which is where, if you like, CMOS technology was 15 years ago or something, or maybe longer, you have to grow that into this $40 billion superconducting industry. So that's an incredible effort. So the fact that the semiconductor industry is so sophisticated, as I point out, makes it extremely hard, even for a technology that's 100 times faster, to actually make it. Now there's another problem, which is, I think, pretty challenging, which is an area where somebody with a clever idea, or several clever ideas can, this is actually a serious problem with this technology, is that you cannot build dense memory chips out of this technology. If you look at the density of chips that you get out of this, it's just not very dense. Now, that doesn't matter for microprocessors because they're so fast. Unfortunately, you end up, if you look at the natural let's not talk about parallelism, we'll talk about just an ordinary sequential superconducting machine. You end up with this, you look at the natural design, there's a wonderful superconducting CPU. It's got about, at best, a quarter of a megabyte of cache memory sitting next to it, built out of superconducting quantum fluxes. And then all this real memory is made out of CMOS DRAM or CMOS SRAM. And unfortunately, that's hundreds or maybe a thousand times slower than the CPU performance. And so you have a terrible problem in the mismatch between the memory performance and the CPU performance. And so it's not so obvious these machines work. So that's a good reason why Intel shouldn't pour its energy into them. And suddenly if you put Microsoft Word on, if you build a superconducting system and put Microsoft Word on it, it'll probably run no faster than the Pentium because it's entirely dominated by memory accesses. Might run slower because this system actually has a smaller cache than some of the best today's microprocessors. So there's a really interesting challenge, which I think the most likely thing to impact this is some clever person who designs a better superconducting memory. And as far as I know, people haven't looked into it. It's just a totally open field. Because I say the whole field was abandoned. In fact, this is the third problem I have. Most people in the field think superconducting technology is ridiculous because IBM had this huge effort which they just terminated. So it has a very bad press or reputation. And they have not realized that in some sense there's been some technical innovation since 1983, which means you should relook at the situation. So actually there's very little work in this field. And now the alternative, which actually is a thing we'll find out that we need to do anyway, is that we need to find new software and new clever algorithms that allow such computers with very bad memory hierarchies with a huge ratio of CPU performance to memory speed in the wrong way, namely memory is too slow. That you'll find actually is going to be true of most machines. This is particularly bad here, but we need new software and new algorithms which will alleviate that. But I don't think that's going to get you a factor of 1,000, at least that's my intuition. I think that's got to be some clever person who there's some obvious remarks you can make. In these superconducting fluxes, they only use n equals 1. But n can be anything. So you might be able to build memories which had lots of higher levels of quantization and get, so not have a 0 or 1 bit as the unit, but maybe 1024 as the basic unit. Who knows? I, as far as I know, this is an open field which is not explored. If the federal program, which I was associated with trying to plan, actually takes off, I do expect there to be significant work in this area. And I believe the federal government will try to sponsor substantial activities, especially in these basic issues. Can this technology be improved to cure its seemingly fatal or fundamental problems? So I expect to see that the corresponding talk 5 years from now will be able to make a difference. There may not be superconducting. I doubt that there'll be serious superconducting machines 5 years from now, but we ought to at least know whether we can. I think it's quite likely somebody will have built better memories by then.